Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast was co-hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure and Civil Rights Practice Groups. It was recorded on Wednesday, October 9th, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the ongoing gun litigation in the Seventh Circuit. My name is Christian Corgan, and I am Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome David Thompson, Managing Partner at Cooper & Kirk, who represents the plaintiffs in the litigation. On Thursday, October 3rd, Mr. Thompson argued an emergency motion before a three-judge panel for an injunction to bar the state of Illinois from enforcing a ban on carrying firearms in public. A more complete bio and description were provided to you in notice of the call, so I will stop there and preserve more time for his presentation, followed by your questions. Mr. Thompson, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Christian. I appreciate it, and it's good to be with everyone this afternoon. I thought what I'd do is just start with a little bit of background on the Shepard case for those who aren't familiar with it, and then dive into a bit more detail about what transpired in the Seventh Circuit last week and where we are. So as you all may know, Illinois was the only state in the union that had a flat ban on the carriage of a firearm outside of the home. The District of Columbia has a similar ban, and that's being challenged in a case called Palmer, but no other state had such a regime. And so we brought suit on behalf of Mary Shepard and the Illinois State Rifle Association to challenge this ban. Mary Shepard's story is really a compelling one. She is licensed to carry a concealed firearm in Florida and Pennsylvania. She's taken at least five training and safety classes with firearms. And unfortunately, a couple of years ago when she moved to Illinois, she was no longer able to carry her firearm. And she works as the treasurer of a church in southern Illinois, and a very large criminal thug came into the church, beat her savagely, left her for dead, cracked her vertebrae, perforated her eardrums. If you go to YouTube and you put in Mary's name, you'll see a video that is just heartbreaking. This criminal also beat the 83-year-old secretary within an inch of her life too. He literally thought they were dead, and you know, without a firearm, Mary wasn't able to defend herself. We went to the district court and filed for relief, and the district court ruled that there was no right to carry a firearm outside of the home. It did so notwithstanding the fact that the Constitution says there is a right to keep and bear arms. Surprisingly, most courts, if you just did a head count, most courts have agreed with the district court that restrictions on carriage outside the home can be tolerated. We appealed, obviously, and were consolidated with a case that Alan Gura had brought in the Central District of Illinois called Moore. And those cases were heard in tandem in the summer of 2012 in front of a panel of the Seventh Circuit that included Judge Richard Posner. And in December of last year, Judge Posner ruled, and he followed the text and the history and really the same methodology that was used in Heller and McDonald. And in this regard, it was a very unusual opinion, because with the exception of Judge Kavanaugh in a dissent in Heller 2 and Judge Elrod on the Fifth Circuit, you know, all the other courts of appeals that have been looking at Second Amendment issues have done interest balancing. And this is really an act of massive judicial resistance. Justice Alito, in his controlling opinion in McDonald, said there was to be no interest balancing, you looked at the text and the history, and that's what decides the issue. And that has been disregarded pretty much across the board, except by Judge Posner in his ruling. And he said when he looked at the text, when he looked at the history, it was crystal clear to him that there was a right to carry a firearm outside of the home. Now, Judge Posner did something that was, to our knowledge, extremely unusual. He gave the state 180 days to put in place a regime that would place limits on the right to carry outside of the home. So a permitting regime, presumably a regime that limited sensitive places that a firearm couldn't be carried. And as the 180-day deadline became close, the state asked for a 30-day extension, and Judge Posner granted it to them, but said there would be no further extension. So the state had 210 days, and, you know, in our research, we could not find any case in which the Bay Court in modern times, in recent times, had granted, you know, an act or a governmental actor that was in clear violation of the Constitution so much time to remedy it. On the 210th day, on the morning of the 210th day, Illinois had still not passed the law. The legislature passed it, but the governor had vetoed it, and the legislature was coming back into special session for the purpose of considering whether to override the veto. That morning, the Seventh Circuit issued the mandate instructing the district court to enjoin Illinois' ban on carriage. Later that day, Illinois legislature did override the governor's veto, and there is now a regime that will allow carriage one day. But the law said that for the next, well, first it said that the state had up to 180 days to make applications available, and then that it could take up to another 90 days in order to grant those applications. So essentially, having waited 210 days, the state said, okay, and we're going to grant ourselves a 270-day extension before anyone can carry a firearm outside of a home. And footnote, it could be a lot longer than 270 days because under the Supreme Court's 11th Amendment jurisprudence, particularly Pennhurst, there'll be no way for a federal court to enjoin a state to obey state law. And there are other requirements like you get your firearms ID card within 30 days. That's now running 90 days. In Illinois, they are way behind, and there is no indication at all that 270 days will be the actual limit. Within 30 minutes of passing the passage of the law, Illinois filed a motion saying that our case was moot. We responded later that day with a motion requesting a preliminary injunction, asking for the court to, in fact, go ahead and enjoin the law that we had challenged. It's important to note that Illinois did not repeal the law that Mary Shepard challenged. If she were to walk out of her home today with a firearm, she would be arrested under the very same provision that she had challenged. Instead, what the state legislature did was create a safe harbor for those with a concealed carry permit, but it's a safe harbor that doesn't go into effect for, you know, at least 9 months. And so, you know, our view was that it was not moot. And in fact, we don't know of any mootness case where someone would be arrested or impacted in the same way under the same provision of law and the case was deemed moot. But that's what the district court held. And so we filed an emergency appeal in the Seventh Circuit. The Seventh Circuit had us brief the case in about a week, in early August, but then put us into a holding pattern for 2 months before argument was held. Argument was held last Thursday, and I believe the argument is up on the Seventh Circuit's website. You know, it's always perilous to predict exactly what a court is going to do, but I think in this instance, Judge Posner, you know, was not hiding his cards and viewed with extreme skepticism, I guess would be the most polite way to phrase his reception of the arguments I made, extreme skepticism. He called it a triviality that we had come to before his court. He invoked Brown versus Board of Education, saying, you're having to wait a few months. The people in Brown, you know, had to wait many years. When I suggested to him that maybe Brown versus Board of Education wasn't a model of constitutional adjudication in terms of the time it took for that, you know, grievous injuries to be remedied, you know, he started fulminating, are you saying the Supreme Court violated the Constitution, which seemed like an odd reaction given the point I had made. I also made the point that, look, the state has this entirely backwards. The baseline in our country is that the default position is that you get to exercise your constitutional rights in the absence of an administrative mechanism limiting those rights. I posited if there were a 51st State of the Union tomorrow and they did not have a parade permitting regime in place, they couldn't ban parades while they, you know, got their parade permitting regime in place. And Judge Posner said, oh, yes, they could. We're not going to have naked people, nudists, with obscene signs congregating. And of course, the answer to that is, look, they can have laws against indecent exposure and against obscenity, but what they can't do is prohibit all sorts, any sort of public assembly or any sort of parade while they take their sweet time getting an administrative regime in place that would permit. And likewise with campaign finance. If they didn't have a campaign finance regime, could they say no campaigning until we get our campaign finance regime in place? Of course not. But the court was not, certainly did not seem receptive to my argument. So, you know, in terms of where we are, it certainly looks like if I were in Las Vegas and placing odds that at this point, the people of Mary Shepard and the other people in Illinois are going to have to wait until the state decides that it will actually confer licenses, and whether that's in 9 months, or I strongly predict it will be longer than 9 months, but whether it's 9 months or more, you know, time will tell. But that's basically where we are in that case, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Fantastic. Thanks very much for that great explanation and analysis. I think so. We'll move on to questions now. If you do have a question, please press star and then the pound key after you hear the announcement that says the floor mode is on. And again, after that, to request the floor, press star and then the pound key. And a quick programming note, while we're waiting for our questions to come on the line, our next scheduled Teleforum conference call is tomorrow, Thursday, October 10th at 2 p.m. On Clark Neely's new book, Terms of Engagement, How Our Courts Should Enforce the Constitution's Promise of Limited Government. Also on the call will be Eileen O'Connor. So again, that's tomorrow at 2 p.m. From the Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group. All right, well, we do have a couple questions on the line, so we'll start and go right to them now.
Hi, I think that it was mentioned that the Illinois concealed carry law is a safe harbor against the charge of aggravated unlawful use of a weapon, I think is the crime that it's a safe harbor against. And
okay.
I noticed that the Illinois Supreme Court has recently struck down the aggravated unlawful use of a weapon crime. So I wonder where that leaves people today who want to carry. Can there be a safe harbor to a crime that has been found unconstitutional?
It's a very interesting question as to what is the state of play right now. Some of the state's attorneys in some of the counties, and they're counties that tend to be redder counties and more pro-gun, have said they're not going to enforce the current law. And by the current law, I mean the ban on carriage until people are able to get their licenses. But the Illinois Supreme Court, which did just, I guess it was in the last, certainly in the last month, but probably about 3 weeks ago, had a very good ruling that followed Judge Posner's decision in saying that they agreed that Illinois' law was unconstitutional. By the way, that was a unanimous decision. But they did drop a footnote and they said, look, we're not commenting or in any way opining on the new law and whether it's legitimate or not. So we are, I don't think someone would ask me, you know, can I carry a gun outside of my home today in Illinois? I'd say, well, you better be careful because some of the state's attorneys have said they're going to continue to arrest people. And I think someone was arrested just in the course of the last week. So it's still very perilous, and rights are still being violated today.
Hi. Just a quick question. Forgive me if it sounds too ignorant, but one of the things that I've been watching in this whole fight is the fact that the last four words of the amendment, shall not be infringed, seem to be, even though Alito said that there shall be no balancing test, what is the argument? Because I've seen this in other Bill of Rights fights where there is debate on a balancing test when, you know, the words shall not be infringed or shall make no law appear. What are the arguments that can we make arguments that will convince the court to get off this track of balancing tests that seem to be so prevalent in constitutional law?
Well, I said in my remarks that what we're really seeing is an act of massive judicial resistance. I believe we're seeing lower courts that just don't like Heller. You know, they don't like the analysis of the majority in Heller, and they're much more attracted to the points that Justice Breyer made. I think there was a Law Review article in the last year called The Triumph of Justice Breyer, and it was basically making this point that everything that Justice Breyer advocated for in his dissent is now the method of adjudication that is proceeding in the lower courts. And I don't think there's really any reason or logic that can be used in this regard, because the proper arguments are being made by the litigants in these cases. It is judicial resistance, and I think it's going to take the United States Supreme Court to intervene and to straighten this out and make clear that, number one, there is a right to carriage, and number two, when they said now twice no interest balancing, they meant it. One of the things that I think, you know, is worth pausing on is reflecting on where are we in terms of the next constitutional carriage case or the seminal carriage case in the Supreme Court. There was a case called Kucholsky out of the Second Circuit. I believe cert has been denied that there. There's a case called Woolard, which is in Maryland, which has a so-called May issue regime, meaning that people, you know, theoretically are permitted to get a license, but it's very difficult there. That is slated for conference this Friday, so we'll find out on Friday or Monday, I suppose, as to whether that's going to be granted. Of course, Illinois could seek cert in the Aguilar case. The time for seeking cert in Shepard and Moore has long since expired. And then there's a case where we filed a cert petition called NRA versus McGraw. Texas has a ban on carriage of 18, 19, and 20-year-olds. So you have a threshold question there of, you know, are 18-year-olds covered? You know, our view is, you know, they were in the militia, so they certainly are covered. And then you get to the second question of, is there a right to carry outside the home? And so that's out there as well. So I think one of those cases, there's also a case called Peruta, which has been pending in front of the Ninth Circuit for a long time. And then, as I mentioned, there's a case called Palmer challenging the D.C. ban on carriage, but that's been stuck in front of the district court for a long time.
Great. This is Christian Corrigan again. We do have one question on the line, and then our lines will be open. So if you would like to ask a question, again, it's star and then the pound key. Press star and then the pound key.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. It seems that what is missing from much of this litigation debate is the introduction of the kinds of regulation that would be constitutionally permissible. The Constitution does suggest that there is such a regulation, but if one examines the historical background for that, it is all regulation that would enhance the effectiveness of militia, such as the Militia Act of 1792, which required people to have weapons and required them to get training and required, perhaps indicated that any weapons they had should meet certain standards of quality and effectiveness. So that door is opened by the Constitution, but if we're going to litigate these issues effectively, we're going to need to show the court that there are regulations allowed, but that these are the kinds of regulations which are the only kind allowed.
Well, and I agree with that. I think we can't suggest that there are no limits whatsoever. For example, you know, if we take age, no one is suggesting that toddlers should have, you know, be wandering around with loaded firearms. And, you know, so that is something that we have in our Texas case, you know, a broad-ranging historical debate with the other side where they claimed it was 21 and we claimed it was 18, but we certainly weren't taking the position that there was no age limit. Likewise, if we look at, you know, violent felons, there's good historical evidence that they're just not even within the scope of the Second Amendment. It's not a matter of balancing anything, but they weren't understood to have Second Amendment rights. And so, you know, we do have to be sensitive to this, and I certainly can say we have been sensitive to that in our and we're acutely sensitive to the need to you know, bring out that both sides of the history.
Well, we have two callers currently pending with questions, and after that, our lines will be open. Again, it's star and then the pound key. And we'll go to the next question.
Hi, I noticed that you mentioned that your client was attacked in a church, and that was the genesis of this lawsuit. And I noticed that the Illinois legislature introduced a bill shortly after the concealed carry law was originally passed. They introduced a bill to add churches to the list of prohibited locations for the carrying of weapons. And I wonder if you could comment on, should that bill pass, would follow-on litigation ensue, and would it just relate to the Second Amendment, or do you see property rights and First Amendment problems with a ban on carrying in church?
Well, and I'm not familiar with the particular piece of legislation. I know Section 65 of the law that was passed back on July 9th, you know, had an extensive list of places where carriage was not allowed. You know, one of the things I think, one of the telltale signs would be, you know, if a church wanted to allow it, would they be permitted to, you know? I think the general baseline in Illinois had been that, you know, if private property owners wanted to prevent carriage, that they could, with the exception of if, you know, that it was locked in a car, in a vehicle, then people couldn't be prohibited from driving on. So I think it's, you know, you're certainly touching on, I think, a sensitive issue because they're competing values. There's certainly the value, the right to exclude is one of the most important sticks in the bundle of property rights. I think generally people have agreed that private residences, you know, if you have a private residence and you don't want someone to have a firearm on your land, then you don't have to invite them on. If you're a place of public accommodation, I think it becomes more of a tricky concept. And certainly if you're in a totally public place like a street or a road, then it's pretty easy. You know, you have to be allowed to defend yourself with a firearm. So I apologize, but I don't know the specifics of it. And I think even if I did, I'd have to concede that that's a nuanced and more difficult question.
Well, we have one more caller currently pending, and then our lines will be open. So, again, if you'd like to ask a question, star and then the pound key.
Again, apologize if I'm beating a dead horse here, but I appreciated your answer on the first time I asked about the shall not be infringed. But the other part that I've been noticing is we seem to still be going towards an argument favoring registration. Is registration not infringement in a particular way? Or
well,
any kind of permitting?
I think it really, first of all, let me say I have not litigated any of the permitting or registration cases, so I'm not as much of an expert on that as I am on, for example, the carriage issue. So take what I say with a grain of salt. But I know this was litigated in the Heller 2 case. And in fact, I think there's been a remand on that. Certainly one of the things to look for is whether the registration system is really intended just to suppress the ability of individuals to exercise their rights. I think in New York City, for example, there is a $360 fee that has to be paid in order to, you know, get a carriage permit, you know, even if you can jump through all the other hoops. And that was challenged in a case called Kwong, K-W-O-N-G. Now, it was a panel in the Second Circuit that had three Republican appointees, I believe. And so it was a good draw for the plaintiff. And yet, plaintiff lost 3-0. Now, one of the things the court said is that the plaintiffs had not made any showing that they themselves in any way had any financial difficulty in making the payment. So I don't know that that case would have come out the same way if there had been indigent plaintiffs who could say, well, you know, I can't exercise my right, or this is a significant burden on my right. And I think in these registration cases, that's certainly something to be looking at. You get the sense as you look at some of these regimes. I think there's one in Hanover County, North Carolina, where you have to get three letters of reference from people who live in that county and are not related to you and don't live with you in order to exercise your Second Amendment rights and be able to carry a firearm outside of your home. That's the sort of thing that looks like being put in place, and whether it has the effect or the purpose of limiting the right, it certainly would have the effect, and I think would be questionable. So that's probably low-lying fruit in that area. And then, you know, it would be more difficult, though, you know, not necessarily impossible, I just don't know, but more difficult to challenge something that's, you know, just a small fee and some paperwork.
Well, the situation that I face is that I've had a father who is an avid gun collector who has a collection of guns that I'd like to bring a portion of into California, but it's cost prohibitive because of all of the registration and fees that I will have to pay to do that.
Well, so you see, I think you would be, you know, in that regard, that's, you know, that is a, I think, a sound, you know, that's the sort of factual predicate that any sort of challenge, I think, should make. Because if there is a real practical impediment to exercising the right, it seems like a real problem. I don't think we would tolerate that in other contexts. It's true that if, you know, you want to have a parade in New York City and the city's going to incur significant costs, then you'd have to pay for it. But where the costs are not tethered to the actual administrative expenses, then I think it's a real problem.
Well, we've got at least one more question on the line. Our lines will be open, and we still have plenty of time left on the call. So if you do have a question for our speaker, press star and then the pound key.
Good afternoon. Thank you for an excellent presentation. My question shifts the focus a little bit. I recently had an experience where I was traveling in some of our western states, and I stopped at gun shops and Walmarts and sporting goods stores in a lot of towns, and they were out or just almost clear out of ammunition. Now, if it could be discovered, or if it eventually is discovered that the government is doing something that affects the supply of ammunition for most firearms, the firearms being useless without ammunition, except, I guess, as wall decorations over the fireplace. Could you comment on that kind of avenue that might be used to get around the Second Amendment?
Yeah, well, I think you're absolutely right that if there is a state actor, whether it be local or state or federal, that is placing impediments on the ability to purchase ammunition, that's a huge Second Amendment problem. We brought another case in Texas, and it's now pending in front of the United States Supreme Court, where the question is whether you have a right to buy a firearm from a federally licensed dealer for 18, 19, and 20-year-olds. They are forbidden by federal law from purchasing a handgun from an FFL. Now, they can go, you know, in the dark of night to a back alley and buy a used handgun lawfully with no background check, you know, out of the back of a van, but they can't go into a Walmart and buy a new handgun, submit to a background check, get a warranty, and make sure it's a, you know, properly functioning firearm that's still in the box and it has a warranty with it. And so, and one of the things, you know, the government, the Obama administration is trying to say is, well, you don't really have a right to buy a gun. And we say, you know, that's nonsense, that of course you have a right to buy a gun. And I would add, apropos of your question, you have a right to buy ammunition too. And this is an issue that is being litigated in the state of New York in response to the Cuomo Act. I think later today, in fact, there'll be a reply brief filed by the plaintiffs in which they talk about the Dormant Commerce Clause. The New York law, I believe, places severe restrictions and maybe an outright prohibition on out-of-state manufacturers providing ammunition. And that's, you know, that could be a Second Amendment problem, but it's also a Dormant Commerce Clause problem. But I think that's certainly something to be looking for. If as you say, if all you have is a paperweight without any bullets, you know, then the Second Amendment certainly been violated.
It looks like we've got two more questions on the line that we'll be able to get to. After that, our lines will be open. So star and then the pound key.
Hi, Mr. Thompson. Thanks a lot for your great work on this issue. And those of us who are lawful gun owners in this country are overjoyed that people like you and Mr. Gora are doing this kind of litigation. So here's my question. And I do litigation, too, in the labor law area. And I've appeared in the Seventh Circuit a few times. And I've appeared before Judge Posner a few times. So here's my question. So Judge Posner wrote this wonderful opinion in Moore versus Madigan, or at least I thought it was a wonderful opinion when I read it. And
yes.
So the question is, what is the deal with federal judges who can issue an opinion like that on our constitutional rights, then see a state engage in massive resistance, and then when someone like you comes back a year later and says, oh, by the way, there's something their nose, nothing's happened, he says to you, why are you here? I'm just sort of curious about the whole thing, and I know Posner can be
mercurial.
Yeah, that's a good word. And I you know, it's not but the point is, I guess I'm just sort of shocked, because when I began to listen to your explanation of this oral argument you just had, I thought you were going to say, I expected you to say, and Posner was, you know, flame on for our side. And so what do you think is the deal here? Because you talk about sort of massive resistance of federal judges who don't like Heller and don't like McDonnell and whatever, but he obviously is not in that camp. So did he, you know, get up on the wrong side of the bed today or what?
Well, my sense of it, giving him every benefit of the doubt, which is certainly more than he gave me, but giving him every benefit of the doubt, I think the main concern he expressed was about safety. One of the points we had made is, look, this isn't going to be the Wild West if you rule in our favor, for a couple of reasons. Number one, we were not challenging in any way, shape, or form the extensive list of places you would not be able to bring a firearm. That may be a different suit for another day, but it wasn't part of this proceeding, number one. Number two, we said there is a permitting regime in place. There is a FOID card, and to get a FOID card, you need to, you know, give a photo ID. You can't be a drug addict, a felon, an illegal alien, you know, have been hospitalized in a mental facility in the last 5 years, and those records are checked every week by Illinois, so they update that database frequently. And so we said, look, there is a permitting regime in place. You're not going to be creating the Wild West. His response to that was, well, wait a minute. The new regime has training. It requires 16 hours of training. If you're licensed somewhere else, you know, you can get credit for up to 8 hours, but then we're going to have 8 hours of Illinois training. And so he said, you know, it doesn't make any sense to allow people out on the streets, you know, who haven't been trained. And then he started asking me about how many hours police officers need to be trained. And the relevance of that was, you know, not clear to me. But what I would say, what we were trying to say with respect to the safety was a couple of points. Number one, I believe there are 42 states in the union where you can carry either concealed or open without any training whatsoever. And there is no empirical evidence whatsoever to suggest that, you know, there are worse outcomes, that there's more accidental shootings or crime or anything like that in those jurisdictions as opposed to the eight where you have to have some measure of training. We're not saying that the training requirement's unconstitutional, but if we're just arguing about what is the practical effect going to be of telling people in Illinois they could start carrying today if they had a FOID card, we didn't think there was no basis in the record or in any literature, forget the record, suggesting that the 42 states that allow you to carry without any training have a problem that the other states don't. In addition, ironically enough, non-residents in Illinois today, right now, can carry a firearm in their car, operable, so if they are licensed in their home state. So Mary Stewart has a Florida license and a Pennsylvania license. If she were a non-resident, you know, she could drive around in her car at least. She wouldn't be able to get out of the car, but at least she'd have it in her car, which would be a lot better than the current regime, but she can't. And so clearly even Illinois itself is recognizing that some forms of carriage don't really, you know, require training today. And I wasn't able to get that point out, but it's a point I would have if I'd been able to speak more freely.
All right. Well, we've got, looks like we have two more questions on the line that we'll go to.
It sounds like it was a bloodbath just to get the legislation that you're currently dealing with in response to the court's ruling. Is there any chance of any type of a legislative approach to this in terms of someone willing to take amendments to the current legislation to shorten the time period that y'all are dealing with? Or is that any possibility of a remedy to your client and others like her?
Yeah, I'm a little bit now beyond my realm of expertise, but my sense of it is that it was a very extensively negotiated legislation where, you know, a lot of people got things they wanted and some people didn't get what they wanted. So it was a real compromise piece of legislation. And, you know, I don't think it's the sort of thing that's going to be reopened. I could be wrong, but, you know, and now the sand in the hourglass is slipping by too, because, you know, we're now into October, so I don't think there's any talk of a legislative fix, which is unfortunate.
Thank you.
And our next caller?
Hello.
Hello.
Bill Pulisi, General Counsel for Illinois State Rifle Association.
Yes, hello. How are you?
How are you today? Fine.
Very good, thanks.
The party who you just spoke with actually presented part of the question I had, and that was with regard to the treatment that you received when you were before Judge Posner. Apparently, from everything I could gather, including with my talk with Bill Howard, you were pretty much handcuffed when you were up there in terms of presenting your argument. Is that correct?
Yeah, I certainly, I mean, anyone can listen to it and draw their own conclusions, but I there were not very many complete sentences that I was allowed to utter.
And of course, when you thought of at least bringing out that portion of your argument as it touched and concerned people that already have carry permits from other states. He never had the opportunity to mention the fact that they already had training in the various requirements pertaining to getting the carry license from the other state. Am I correct?
Yeah, that's right. And certainly at one point I tried to make the point that Mary Shepard had already been trained in two other states. And Judge Posner said, I believe I'm accurately quoting him when he said, well, this isn't about Mary Shepard. And I'm thinking, well, she is the lead plaintiff. So certainly she thinks it's about herself. And it's true that there are broader implications. But certainly, you know, if the court had genuinely been concerned about safety, it could have crafted an injunction saying, look, we're going to strike down the current law for those who have received training already. In fact, Mary Shepard has now, I believe it was last Monday night after 5 p.m., the state of Illinois finally posted the curriculum. Mary completed her training, her full, 8 hours of additional training by Thursday. So, you know, there's no argument why she and everyone else who is similarly situated like her, who has in fact now done the new training, and there's 757 instructors in Illinois who can give that training, why they can't be allowed to carry. When I suggested that as a possible compromise, Judge Posner suggested it was inappropriate for me to be, quote, negotiating with a court. And, of course, I wasn't negotiating with a court. I was just suggesting that any equitable remedy can be tailored to take into concerns, any legitimate concerns the court has.
And, of course, now we are saddled with the time restraints that are set forth relating to the carry license. And we'll have to stick it out as far as waiting for the ultimate time where people can actually carry. It appears to me, too, that no one will see a carry license before February or March of next year.
I think that's exactly right, and it may be longer than that, but I think that's the earliest.
Well, I wish I could talk more. I got into it a little bit late. I'm on my way to meet with other co-counsel on the Wilson case. Good luck, and we certainly appreciate it. That was a great input by you. Thanks so much.
Our pleasure. Thank you so much, Victor.
Well, we have one more question on the line and about 15 minutes to go on the call. So if you do want to ask a question of our expert, please press star and then the pound key.
Hello. Yes, I'm a young lawyer, and I was wondering if y'all had information available either online or through packets that you could send that would allow us to file our own lawsuits, in our own states that would further our Second Amendment rights.
Well, I think, the thing that you want to look at is you want to try to be strategic, right? And we want to try to get as many victories as we can in front of, the relevant courts. And so I know when people look at the sort of blizzard of different rules and regulations that are out there, there's sometimes a temptation to think, well, gee, that's a terrible imposition. We should challenge it. And I would, I guess, really caution that, people are trying to, I think certainly the NRA has been thinking about this for many years strategically, and has, a game plan for the sequencing that they would like to roll these things out on. I'd say that, if there's any law in your jurisdiction that you think is potentially vulnerable, feel free, shoot me an email, give me a call, and happy to talk with you about it offline. But I just think it's important for people not to just race in impulsively and challenge things because we want to do, those who care about the Second Amendment want to make sure that it's consistent with the overall strategy.
Okay. Well, I'm in Arkansas, and our legislator arguably accidentally passed open carry this past session. At least one of the legislators knew what they were doing. They took out the intent portion of, carrying a firearm. Apparently, without a license, you have to have the intent to actually commit a crime against another person now, which was not there before. Just having it was a problem, if you had it concealed or open carried. So, But the problem is our governor and our sheriffs and our state police have been telling people, they've been interpreting it, no, this doesn't change anything. You still can't open carry and things like that. And I was just thinking about challenging that.
Right, and that's something you'd have to do in state court because, as I was adverting to earlier in the call about the 270 days, under the Supreme Court's Pennhurst decision, you cannot sue a state for violating a state law. So there it sounds like what you're describing is, you know, you have under this new statute the right to open carry. Under that state statute, it's being violated by state officers, and so you'd want to sue them in state court. To get that, and it really won't be a Second Amendment claim. It's not to say it's not an important claim, but I think that would be, you know, less, you know, that whenever you're arguing just about the meaning of a statute, then the stakes are a little bit lower, and therefore, you know, there's less of a worry about the overall Second Amendment strategy.
David, this is Christian Corrigan again. We do have a few minutes left on the call, so if there are any final questions, I'd urge our callers to press star on the pound key and ask them now. But one thing I did want to ask you to maybe shed a little light on is, in the aftermath of the Navy Yard shooting several weeks ago, and then even going back to the Fort Hood shooting, there was some discussion that you know, that carriage is not allowed on military bases. Could you shed some light on that and sort of explain that issue for us?
Sure. And I do want to preface this by saying I'm not an expert on this, but let me tell you what my understanding is, which is that under George Herbert Walker Bush, back in February of 1992, there was a Department of Defense directive that was aimed at limiting and controlling the carrying of firearms by DOD military and civilian personnel on bases. And, you know, there was an exception. If you're going to save a life, you could do it. Or if someone sufficiently high up, like in the Navy, a lieutenant commander or a captain, you know, they could give someone permission to carry. But the normal rank and file, but both the junior officers and the enlisted, are not going to be able to carry on a base. And, you know, and then President Clinton codified that in a regulation in 1993. And, you know, unfortunately, this just illustrates the tragic reality that's out there, which is that relying on law enforcement alone to protect ourselves and to defend our basic life just doesn't work. In 1989, there were 168,000 violent crimes where it took the police over 1 hour to respond. Now, at Fort Hood and the Washington Navy Yard, it didn't take over an hour to respond, but when you're dealing with an individual who's armed and nobody else's, minutes count. You know, in the Washington Navy Yard, I think all of this is a little bit in flux, that although the police arrived within 2 minutes, it was 7 minutes before they went in the building, and even if they had gone in after 2 minutes, you know, a lot of damage could be done during that period. In Fort Hood, there was a lag of, there's, I believe, some controversy about whether it was 4 minutes or 14 minutes. But again, even if it's just 4 minutes, that's an eternity, you know, for those who are there and have been stripped of their rights. So I think, I'm glad, Christian, you asked about that, because I think it's illustrative of the problem. There are some, you know, in this debate who say, well, gee, you know, why does anyone need to carry? You know, Illinois was justified in having its ban. You could always just call 911 and the police will come help you. And that's not the real world. You know, criminals don't always, you know, allow you to, you know, ask them to pause their criminal conduct or their assault on your person so that you can, you know, call the police. And even if you can call the police, it often takes them, you know, a long time. And even if it's just minutes and they're incredibly responsive, that's often too late. So really tragedy all around, and particularly tragic that perhaps it could have been avoided or certainly mitigated, you know, if individuals were allowed to carry on bases.
Thank you very much. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our expert, David Thompson, today for his excellent analysis and for giving us not only a great breakdown of the litigation, but also for giving us an insider's perspective from someone who's been involved with the case and deals with it day to day. So thank you very much, and thank you to our audience for asking a number of great questions and facilitating a great discussion. We always welcome your feedback at the Federal Society by email to info@fedsoc.org. Please join us for our next scheduled telephone conference call tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time with Clark Neely and Eileen O'Connor. And always remember to check out the practice group's new Executive Branch Review Project blog, which is at executivebranchproject.com, all one word, executivebranchproject.com. And with that, we're adjourned. Thank you all for joining us.
Great. Thank you, Christian. Take care.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.